So good morning. Welcome to the third day of the MT Marathon. And today we will have two lectures in the morning, one on language modeling by Ken Heafield and the next one on discriminative training by Miloš Stanojevic. So just before I let you, you know, give your lecture, a reminder, these are free copies, so you can take one for yourself. They are still available and there should be enough for everybody. Now, without further ado, I give the floor to Ken.
All right. A brief note about the title. P of modeling with one L given language is higher than P of modeling with two L's given language. So in defense of being American. On your cell phone, when you type, it's predicting the next word. This is an old version of Android, and it's reasoning that the word type is more probable than Tyler or typing in the context of predictive. And we can formalize that by saying this is a probability distribution, it's conditional, you might even say it's near the beginning of sentence. But also in Microsoft Word, there are these blue underlines that appear when you have a word that exists in the vocabulary, loose, but is inappropriate in context. The green one is actually a light parser and the red one is just a vocabulary. And it's reasoning that the probability of the word lose is much higher, so it's saying you probably said something incorrect there. I went to Taiwan and saw this interesting translation, in-room lukewarm water swimming pool. It didn't seem that appetizing, but even without being able to read any of those Chinese characters, one can reason that they probably meant it's an indoor swimming pool and maybe it's heated or something instead of being completely cold. So the point is that without being able to read the input sentence, you can still form a better translation just by knowing something about the target language. And that means being able to model the target language is important. Another translation example is the French word chambre translates as bedroom. So clearly, if you have président de la chambre des représentants, chairwoman of the bedroom of representatives, this is from WMT 2009. That's an actual part of a system output, and it's referring to Nancy Pelosi in this case. One way you can fix this is by memorizing phrases, and phrase-based MT should hopefully get this correct by saying House of Representatives and Chambre des Representants are translationally equivalent. But even if you don't know any French, you can reason that it probably meant chairwoman of the House of Representatives. Also in speech recognition, thanks to Weird Al Yankovic, we know that another one bites the dust is slightly more probable than another one rides the bus. So in all of these applications, there's an essential component that asks, what's the probability of a string? And yes, I even have a Czech translation example up there that's down the street at some mall. There's LA Finger Food, which serves food in the raw. And in all of these cases, we need some way of asking what's the probability of some string. And if we can do a better job or a faster job at answering that question, then we can make all of these applications higher quality and hopefully faster as well. So what does the language model do? It's ideally modeling the fluency of the output language. It doesn't care about the input at all, at least in the normal application of language models. I realized yesterday you saw language models being used for translation where the words are actually phrase pairs. But ignoring that application and going back historically to what language models mean, it doesn't model how well you're translating the source. It doesn't know how long the source is, but in principle, it could be something as simple as the length of the target sentence. That is, in some sense, a poor language model. But in practice, there's more powerful language models than those simple features I listed. So parsing could, in principle, be a language model. You run a parser, get the probability, and that is a probability distribution over sentences. But the dominant use case of language models is sequence models that go left to right, and that's mostly what I'll cover in this talk. So just a quick example of parsing. You can ask the probability that Moses compiles, and that's a parse tree where you have a sentence, and it's kind of a weird sentence. It's only two words. But you can multiply all of the rule applications in the parse tree, and that gives you a probability that Moses compiles. In sequence models, you can go from left to right, and this is simply applying the chain rule, so you predict the first word, and then the second word given the first word. There's no Watson accuracy yet. This is exactly a theorem under the chain rule, and this is modeling words the same way you would type them on a phone, for instance, left to right. And you can extend this all the way to a sentence. So a sentence, in this case, we have little special sentence markers for the beginning and end of sentence, and they look like HTML tags with the S and slash S on them. And that's just saying we want to explicitly model that some words are more probable at the beginning of a sentence than other words, and also it's more likely that a sentence will end after a period, but it's not always the case, i.e., and all these abbreviations may not be the end of a sentence, so we have an explicit end of sentence marker instead. And you can add all of these in log space or multiply all of them in probability space, and you get a probability for the entire sentence. And now the next question is, where do we get these probabilities from? I'm showing log probabilities because we end up having very small probabilities for words, and it's nicer to put them in log space. And also, when you multiply really small things, they get so small that they tend to underflow, and then you end up with probability of sentence equals zero, which is a bad thing. So it's nicer to work in log space where you can add things together, and that's why most of this talk uses log space. But the question is, where am I getting this right-hand column from? And that's going to be the first section of this talk. So the short answer, the rough answer, is they come from text. You stuff Wikipedia in, do some hand-wavy modeling, and out comes the probability distribution of the word raw given in the. And one straw man way you could do this is you find every instance of in the in Wikipedia, and count how many of them have in the raw. So in this toy example here, you get the probability of raw given in the is 1/4, approximately. But what about Ugrasena? It turns out in the Ugrasena does not appear on Wikipedia. Should we give it a probability of zero, or do we want to estimate some non-zero probability for that? Because in principle, it could be part of a grammatical sentence. Ugrasena is a Hindu god, and you can have in the Ugrasena kingdom. So what we want to do is steal some probability from Ra and give it to Ugrasena somehow. And that's what smoothing is. That's the next section of this talk. So smoothing is intended to address this problem that appeared on the previous slide, that if we have counts and we have this count-based method, then you end up with zero. And we don't want to do that, so what do we do about it? Well, we could simply say, if I haven't seen in the Ugrasena, maybe I've seen the Ugrasena, and forget words until I've eventually seen something that does match. And in this hypothetical example, we'll pretend that the Ugrasena appears on Wikipedia, and therefore we can assign it some non-zero probability. And this simple technique has a name. It's called stupid back off. And it's published by Google, and the idea is you just drop context words on the left, the furthest away context word, until you eventually have a non-zero count. Disclaimers, these stupid back-off values are not actual probabilities. They don't sum to one. You can think about why that might be the case. But the rest of this, ideally, would be less stupid than stupid back-off. This is the name they gave it in the paper. There's a footnote in their paper explaining how they thought it couldn't possibly work, but then the name stuck. So that's how they ended up with it. Yes. Well, not as well as Kinesier Nye smoothing, I contend. So how can we be smarter than this? There's one option, which is increasingly popular among you kids these days, neural networks, and that's predicting the next word with a classifier. And there's the older version, but still heavily used which is back off, where we formalize this idea that if in the Ugrasena wasn't seen, maybe the Ugrasena was seen, but we do a slightly better job at estimating it than stupid back off does. And overall, this is part of a larger talk where this is the outline of everything. We start with neural networks and back off for smoothing, and then I'll go into specifically one flavor of smoothing, and finally, how do you implement these things at a hopefully high level. So, neural networks. We need to turn words into vectors. This was alluded to in some of the lectures you've seen before, and the simplest way to turn words into vectors is you just have a vector that's one for the vocabulary ID of that word and zero for everything else. This also limits your vocabulary size because now you have to have matrices and vectors whose dimensionality is equal to the vocabulary. And we can stuff this into a recurrent neural network. I'm hiding a bunch of stuff in this blue box here, but the idea is you start with some state at the beginning of sentence, and you start with the beginning of sentence symbol, feed that into your magical blue box neural network, and it outputs a probability distribution over the next words, as well as some state vector. And then you tell it, I saw the word raw at the beginning of sentence, well, after the beginning of the sentence. You feed that word vector into the neural network along with the state that it gave you before, and then it's going to feed out yet another probability distribution and another state vector. I'm showing you choice state lengths of 3 and a vocabulary size of 4 here, but in practice you might have a vocabulary of 100,000 and a state vector of 400 floats passing between each of these. And this is a recurrent neural network, and you can train it to optimize for the probability of the words that are seen empirically in sentences. So this is treating the prediction problem as a classification problem, which is fairly natural, but it's not necessarily the case for generative models that we'll see next. And one thing to note about this is that it's using the entire sentence in principle because it's carrying this floating point state vector all the way from the beginning of sentence to the end. And if you change the word at the beginning of sentence, the state vector might be completely different. In other words, it has this nice infinite context accounting which can do long distance things, at least in principle, like keeping track of the gender of a noun at the beginning of sentence and using it much later at the end of sentence. Whether or not it's actually capable of doing that in practice is another question, but it has this nice property that the model could do it in theory. So another thing we can do is turn words into vectors, and the way we do this is you can actually read off how the recurrent neural network is internally representing each of those words by looking inside the neural network and reading the first layer that's used to process these one-hot vectors. Or you can read your favorite ACL paper, and about half of the papers in ACL these days seem to be producing these word vector things. And this is just a better way to represent words that's hopefully dense and allows you to have much larger vocabularies by expressing them as vectors of floating point numbers. So once we have these vectors, we can run a different sort of neural network where we say, I'm going to take the vector for the word in and the vector for the word the, I append them together, and that goes at the bottom layer of as input to a neural network. And then the prediction problem is predict the word raw. And this is different from the previous one because it has finite memory. It's only looking at the previous two words in this case. In general, you can have it look at the previous 5, or if you're Holger Schwenk, the previous 13. And then you have this nice prediction for the next word, but it's forgetful. It's not able to remember all the way back to the beginning of sentence. But it's another way to do neural network language models, and I'm introducing you to a bunch of smoothing techniques. So the next approach, which is more classical, is back off, where we just forget words until we've seen something in the training data. And this is more, shall we say, generative. The idea in backoff smoothing, which we saw a bit earlier with stupid backoff, is if you haven't seen in the Ugrasena, hopefully you've seen the Ugrasena. So approximately, we want to say the probability of Ugrasena given in the is about equal to Ugrasena given the. That's the intuition here. As you forget words that are further and further away from the one you're trying to predict, then hopefully the probability distributions are approximately equal. And this can continue recursively. So if we haven't seen the Ugrasena, then it becomes the probability of Ugrasena. And we just base it on how frequently we've seen that word. And as the very, very backup case, if we haven't seen the word at all, there's just a fixed probability that we assign to it, the unknown word. However, we actually change this slightly and charge a penalty for being unable to match that context. So the backoff B here is saying, in the actually strongly predicts what the next word is going to be. Or maybe it doesn't strongly predict that, but we want to measure how strongly does the context predict what the next word will be. So San tends to predict, well, Spanish words or names of cities, San Francisco, San Antonio, and it has a much tighter probability distribution over the words that follow, and it would be expected to have a higher penalty for producing some word that was not seen right after San in the training data. Whereas in the, it's followed by almost an open class word, so it should have a low backoff penalty. And similarly, the, a lot of things can follow the. So it should be low, but we want to be able to measure this as a function of the context that was not able to be matched at the time. And in a backoff model, that's all that happens. We have this probability of the word given less context, and we charge a penalty for not being able to match that context. And it can happen recursively. So you see the probability of Ugrasena given the could actually be further approximated in the second line by adding another backoff penalty. And there can be, in general, multiple backoff penalties charged depending on how far it has to go to find a match. So let's look at it, this in a different way. In practice with an n-gram language model, and this is just a classic generative version, not a neural version, you memorize a bunch of strings that were seen in the training data. They have a log probability associated with them and a log backoff associated with them. The beginning of sentence token has a minus infinite, you can see on the top left, because you should never see the sentence begin after it's already begun. That would be that only happens if Moses doesn't compile right. And then there's these backoff penalties that the unigrams and the bigrams have, but the trigrams, I'm doing a trigram language model here, so this can only memorize up to two words of context. If you match the longest n-gram, there's no penalty. So there isn't a backoff for the trigrams. And an example query, if we look up is given the beginning of sentence in Iran, and it happens to be in the language model, great. Just return the log probability field. It's been memorized and stored in RAM. But if we're given a more complicated query, the probability of given Iran is, then we don't match it in the trigrams. Iran is of doesn't appear there. Neither does is of. So we back off all the way to of, and that's the probability term. And there's also a penalty for not being able to match Iran is, that's the bottom line, and for not being able to match is, that's the middle line. So in order to execute this query, the language model actually has to retrieve all of those floating point values from memory. And that's where it becomes interesting to implement, and that's why you want to be able to fetch all these things from memory in parallel, hopefully, instead of in serial. Do my MT Marathon project. So the idea in backoff, or the n-gram language models, for neural networks is that closed words matter more, and implicitly the same thing is being encoded in this recurrent neural network because it's going left to right and evaluating the closer words next to each other, even though it's able to go all the way back to the beginning of sentence. But there are some exceptions to this rule. You might have number agreement, gender agreement. You want to have the same topic within a sentence. So there are reasons why long-distance language modeling would be useful, But predominantly in the statistics, you see local behavior. And that's mostly what language models are capturing. It may also be why we do a poor job in machine translation of having long-distance agreement. There is a subtle alternative in an ACL paper you can look up that's somewhat interesting and has a different take on Kinesio-Nye smoothing with better perplexities. That's all I'm going to say about it for now. And let's move on to a specific kind of backup. Where do I get those log P and log B values that I showed you in earlier slides? They come from text, but I haven't actually said how they're computed. So there are multiple methods for smoothing. Kinesio-Nye smoothing is one of them. It happens to be most successful, or in the words of Chris Kellis and Birch, it's withstood the test of time. But there are also other flavors of smoothing, Wittenbell and Good Turing, that you'll see as options in a lot of language model building programs. And they can also be useful for not quite language modeling tasks like, well, maybe if you want to predict pairs of words, I don't know if Kinesio-Nye smoothing is the best, or you're doing phrase table smoothing. These techniques have also been adopted to other areas. So Kinesio-Nye smoothing is pretty common, and the reason it's common is that it has good quality. I'm referring to the specific flavor of Kinesio-Nye smoothing called modified Kinesio-Nye smoothing in this talk, which was published a few years after the original Kinesio-Nye paper. And it has three steps in order to build it. This is a rough outline for the next three slides or so. So I'm not expecting you to understand what adjust, normalize, and interpolate mean just now, but that's what I'm going to explain in the next few slides. So adjusted counts, this is a specific term that John Clark and I use to refer to something that exists inside of Kinesio-Nye smoothing. I'd say it's not necessarily standard terminology, but it's the one we have in our source code. And the definition is that the highest order keeps the same count. So if I have a trigram language model, I'm going to count all of the trigrams, those strings of three words that I see in the text, and I'm going to keep their counts. But for the lower orders, the bigrams and the unigrams, one of the central observations in Kinesio-Nye smoothing is that you only query P of Ugrasena if you didn't match P of the Ugrasena. And similarly, you only query P of the Ugrasena if you didn't match in the Ugrasena. So what Kinesio-Nye smoothing says is these lower orders, the ones that will only be queried if you couldn't match something higher, can be conditioned on not having matched something higher. So it's not just P of Ugrasena given the, it's P of Ugrasena given the, and I was not able to match the word before that. And this adjusted counts is trying to capture that in a formal mathematical way, which in practice maps to how many words have you seen to the left. So those probabilities of P of Ugrasena given the should be based on how freely does it associate with some word that it might not have matched to the left. And that's captured by the number of unique words. So just a quick example of what this actually looks like in practice. If you've got some trigrams that have been counted, then of has two unique words to the left in this toy example here, namely one and two. And one of has R and is to the left. So you could implement this by counting all the trigrams and then generating this table of adjusted counts for the bigrams and the unigrams from that. Discounting and normalization is the next step, and this is more complicated. But the way to summarize it is, remember that P of raw given in the was just the count of in the raw divided by the count of in the. It's maximum likelihood normalization. This is looking exactly like maximum likelihood normalization, where the adjusted count is in the numerator, and you sum up all the other options. So the count of in the should be the sum of all the n-grams that have alternatives like raw or in this talk or anything that follows in the is captured in that denominator. It's just there's this extra term in there that's thrown in to say, I'm stealing some mass from you. And that's saving space for unseen events like Ugrasena. So sorry this slide is more complicated and it has an ugly formula on it, but the idea is that we want to compute these not quite yet probabilities by doing the same thing you would do with stupid backoff or maximum likelihood normalization, but we're saving some space for the unseen words. And I'm glossing over some of the details of Kanasier-Nye smoothing. I didn't tell you where those discounts come from, but the last step here is interpolation. A lot of people use the word interpolation to refer to, I've got a model on European Parliament data, I've got a model on Twitter, and I'm going to interpolate them to create a model on Facebook or something. But actually, interpolation also happens within a single language model. And the idea is that you've seen the word of a lot. So you're fairly confident in your estimate of the probability of. But some of the words might have been seen less frequently. And if you only have a count one or something of a word, then you give a little bit of mass to everyone. And this is equivalent to interpolating with the uniform distribution. This is just saying, well, I don't quite know what the correct probability is. If I interpolate a bunch of things, then maybe I'll get a slightly better probability distribution. And the way this works is it gives 1/1 vocabulary to everything. Interestingly enough, the unknown word has a pseudo probability of 0. So the only way in which a word that hasn't been seen at all gets any mass from this is by interpolating with the uniform distribution. It gets a very small, according to this formula, back off of the empty string divided by the size of the vocabulary probability. If you don't use SRILM. And then the idea is, if the probability of the word of in the context one, we've seen this n-gram less often, the one of, by definition in a sense, occurs less often than the probability, than the word of. So we want to interpolate it. We want to mix this very sparse n-gram with more dense information that we've seen by counting the word of. And you can visualize this by saying, I want to take the probability of an n-gram with its interpolation weight and output some overall final probability. So this has been the most complicated section of the talk, but the slides will be up in the near future. And this is just trying to walk you through the math of an admittedly pretty complicated smoothing method, but give you some intuition about why it's doing each of the steps. So we've done this smoothing technique. There's reasons for each of them listed up here. And there is a justification for them. There's also some even more gory details that I'm hiding from you. But at the end of the day, you get a probability distribution and some backoff weights, and Andre is going to ask a question.
The machine translation application, if we do not leave space for unseen events, so if we allow our probabilities to add more to than one?
No.
Well, nothing would break.
It wouldn't break anything as to whether you would get better quality or not in the end. I mean, people run MT with stupid backoff. So the model doesn't segfault or something if it doesn't sum to one. What does break slightly is we have a length feature. And the model has ultimately, you can think of it as language model probability plus lambda times length. And that length is meant to compensate for the fact that the probability in log space keeps going down as you add more and more words. So it's supposed to compensate for that effect on average. But if it's not able to do that, it should arguably be the sum of the probabilities for each word then. So there is some slight breakage there, but it's not too bad.
So you never observed that, you never observed any effects on the translation quality or?
Oh, there is effect in translation quality. Okay, probably the best citation for this is the neural networks people who want to approximately normalize things. And you can see there's a graph in Jacob Devlin's paper of how much he puts into normalizing it and the translation quality going down when you don't normalize that much. But nothing requires things to sum to one. Also, well, it just assumes that on average it's close to one. Separately, I don't think we even need to have a probability distribution over the sentence or something that multiplies to a probability distribution over a sentence, but that's another debate to have. Okay, implementation. So we've got this crazy smoothing thing, and we've also got to store these probability and backoff values. How do we store them? How do we make this efficient? If you don't care about math but care about systems, this is the section to listen to. And why does this matter? Well, according to Spence Green's benchmarks, language model queries are 50% of the CPU usage in a machine translation system. So ideally, you want to make that fast. Also, we have a language model with 500 billion unique n-grams in it, and we want to store that in RAM. So that's on a machine with a terabyte of RAM, you get about 2 bytes per key value pair to store these floats in somehow. So we want this to be fast and memory efficient because it takes about 1 million queries to the language model to translate a single sentence. So the first part here is how do we get a language model? And the first thing you do to get a language model is you count n-grams. And one way we could do this is you scan through the text and just fill a hash table with all of the n-grams and count them up. But that's going to run out of RAM because there can be a lot of n-grams. So what do? Well, we fill up a hash table and then write to the disk. And then we fill up the hash table again and write to the disk when that's full, et cetera, et cetera. And those of you familiar with MapReduce should recognize that this is a combiner followed by a spill to a reducer. But even if you're not familiar with MapReduce, this is just a way to manage the memory in a hash table. And then once you've got all these separate files, you can sort them and put them together. Or if you want to be slightly more efficient, you can sort the data before it hits the disk and then run merge sort on top of that. So we have this problem, and we need to process a lot of records, but it's a batch problem. We actually, in training, can very carefully control the order in which you're going to access records because we know what the next steps are going to be. We know how Kinesernized smoothing works, and that's a batch process. So this is not a complete solution, but one of the ways in which we can handle this is by doing split and merge, and by doing sequential operations on disk, like merge sort and dumping a hash table to a file. And actually, I'm hiding some details from you, but stupid backoff you can do in one pass because all it needs to do is count n-grams, and I just showed you on the previous slide how you do that. Kinesernized smoothing, you need to do 3 passes of this in order to create a big Kinesernized smooth language model. But what about queries? So all this training stuff I just talked about has batches, and that means we can do sequential access to disk, blah, blah, blah. But queries, we don't know where they're going to come from. In principle, we know a little bit that probably when you're scoring a sentence, there's going to be some topical coherence, or in a machine translation system, there's a bunch of different variations being scored, but it's far less structured, and we don't actually have a good sense of what query is going to come next. So we need completely different data structures for queries, And let me just show you how a query might be executed in practice. So regressing a bit to stupid backoff, but you can also envision Knaser Nye smoothing implemented in a similar way. If we have this stupid backoff equation up here, this is the super formal version of it, but in practice on the bottom, if we're querying the not quite probability of few given is one of the, then we first look up the entire n-gram, and in this hypothetical example, yay, it's found, but we also need to look up the denominator in order to compute 5 over 12 and return that. But what if it's not found? So if we have periwinkle is one of the periwinkle, then we suppose that we're not finding all of these matches and that they're zero, and eventually we find the periwinkle. So this is, in some sense, an optimistic search order. It's trying to find the longest match, and then if it doesn't find that, it gives up on one word at a time, and it keeps doing lookups into some hash table or something, some sparse representation of n-grams, and not finding things, and then it eventually finds a match. And then it still needs, at the bottom, to retrieve the denominator in order to return 3 over 1,000 as the stupid backoff. So we have some way to store n-grams, right? And we need to be able to execute each of those queries and say, oops, it's not in here, or here is the count, or in general, here is the probability in backoff if you're doing a full backoff model. And how do we do this efficiently? Well, we have a giant hash table, again, with n-grams as keys, and the counts are values, or the probabilities in backoffs are values. The difference here from training is that this is a static read-only hash table. You never need to insert anything. You never need to delete anything from it because you've compiled the model and now it's read-only and it's stored in read-only memory, basically. So one quick trick here is if you have a hash table with keys, forget the original keys and replace them with 64-bit hashes. Or as Google likes to say, we're not a bank. If two web pages accidentally have the same hash, probably no one will notice. And that joke used to work until Bank of America actually assigned two people the same account number, and they screwed up in exactly the way you'd expect a hash collision to. But the point is, if you have 64-bit hashes, in expectation, if you have less than 2 to the 32 or about 4 billion keys, then there won't be any collisions. And if you have more than 2 to the 32 keys, you probably shouldn't use this data structure. Yes, I just said that. So how do we implement a hash table? Fun facts about C++ is that the boost unordered map, or your favorite GCC integrated hash map, is integrated as a chaining hash table. That means it has an array of buckets, and when you do a lookup, it goes into that array, it finds the appropriate bucket, and then it does chain, which is to say it follows a linked list of all the records that fall into that bucket. So these pointers and circles, the pointers are meant to be linked list pointers, and the circles are saying, here's an entry in the hash table. And that means whenever you want to look up an entry in a hash table that exists there, it's at least doing two random memory accesses, one to find the bucket array and another one to follow the linked list pointer. And it might do yet another one to follow another linked list pointer, depending on how many entries there are in the hash table. Now let's talk about a different hash table, and this is a slightly complicated slide, but it's explaining open addressing. And the idea is store the records directly in the hash table, directly in the buckets. So instead of having a pointer, we just say, I'm going to hash this n-gram, take that hash modulo 6 in this case, I'm going to have a hash table with 6 buckets in it. And ideally, there are these records that want to be at offset 2, but if there's multiple records that hit the same bucket, we just move to the next one. So the query procedure for a linear probing hash table is look up the ideal bucket and scan forward until you either find the key you were looking for or you find a blank, which we just encode as a zero hash and hope that no one else has a zero hash. And a linear probing hash table is more efficient in terms of random memory accesses because there's only one random memory access and then a linear scan forward in order to retrieve a single record. There's also yet another data structure. So you can use Marcin and have a minimal perfect hash table. The idea behind a minimal perfect hash is it is a function that will go from keys, in this case n-grams, to an integer. So it will assign a unique integer to every n-gram, and you tell it the set of n-grams that you want it to do this for in advance. And then that hash function, it actually requires some memory to store it, but you can use those as array offsets then. So you can say, I'm going to give every n-gram a unique array offset and just have a dense array of n-grams with their values in them. But, disclaimer, while it assigns a unique integer to every n-gram that exists in your language model, it will happily stab you in the back and give you an integer offset if you hand it an n-gram that doesn't exist in the language model. And it will just hand you an integer and say, I think it's at that address. So that's a problem. And how do we get around that? Well, we still give the n-gram that we want to look up to the minimal perfect hash. But in that array, we're going to store a little bit of the hash of the n-gram. And if those hashes match, then great, we assume that the n-gram is in there. And if those hashes don't match, then we say that the n-gram is not in there. So now the question is, how much of a hash do we store there? And there's this potential for false positives because, because we might have low memory by storing a minimal perfect hash table. It's memory efficient. But there's this risk that we might have a hash collision. The fingerprints might match accidentally, and we'll say someone is in the table when they shouldn't have been. Less memory, but not as much less memory as a minimal perfect hash table, is an array. Fun thing is if I hand you a dictionary and I ask you to look up the word zebra, do you open it at the middle or do you open it near the end? That's what interpolation search does. And it's actually, there's some paper from the 70s that proved that it's log n under a uniform distribution assumption. And you can make the keys uniform by randomly permuting your vocabulary IDs. So now we can look at, briefly, here's the speed of a bunch of data structures. At the top, I've got some hash tables. So green and blue are your favorite C++ hash tables. The linear probing one is actually slower for a small number of entries, but it gets faster with more entries. And what's happening on the right there is you can see each of them has a slope going down where it gets much slower. That's when the size of the data structure gets larger than the CPU's cache. But once that happens, the chaining hash tables have to do two random memory accesses outside of cache. And the linear probing hash table only has to do one memory access outside of cache. And so it ends up being faster for larger hash tables. And in most cases, we care about the write on here because language models are big. You can store language models in a try, and this is yet another data structure. The idea here is if you want to look up the n-gram Australia is one, then you look up the word one, then the word is, and then Australia, and there's this tree data structure that allows you to look up each word by finding a pointer from the previous one. There's also some crazier tricks you can play by quantizing values and probability and backup, it actually turns out you can express them as a single float if you're willing to compromise a bit on search accuracy. But it will produce the same language model. So quickly summarizing here, there are a bunch of ways you can implement the storage for a language model, but it's fundamentally a problem of how do I map a sparse set of n-grams to probability and backoff. And there's tricks you can play to do that. So language models measure fluency, ultimately, and that's useful for a bunch of tasks. You can use neural networks, you can use this generative backoff story, and we also need to have good data structures to efficiently implement things.
Thank you, and then... Thanks for the great overview and all the details as well. Are there any questions to the language modeling lecture? So if not, then, well, Kenneth is here for the rest of the week anyway, so we can talk to him about the implementation details.